It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new survey asks UW-Madison students how they feel about a variety of free speech issues. We'll talk to the head of that survey about the results and why he's calling on the university to require more education about the First Amendment. First, we'll take a look at the way law enforcement responded to the pro-Trump riot at the Capitol 2 weeks ago. President-elect Joe Biden tweeted on January 7th, the day after, quote, "No one could tell me that if it had been a group of Black Lives Matter protesters yesterday, that they wouldn't have been treated very differently than the mob that stormed the Capitol. We all know that's true, and it's unacceptable," end quote. People have pointed to what happened to racial justice protesters over the summer at Lafayette Square in D.C. as an example of unequal treatment by law enforcement. Police there used pepper spray and force against protesters, and President Trump referred to them as thugs. In a new survey from USA Today and Suffolk University, 55% of respondents thought that the police response would have been harsher if the January 6th rioters had been mostly Black. 28% thought the response would have been about the same, 9% milder. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What are your feelings about the police response to the pro-Trump protests and then insurrection? How should law enforcement have responded, in your opinion? How do you compare and contrast police response to protests in the summer of 2020? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nicole Alexander Floyd is an associate professor of political science at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, and an author. Her forthcoming book is Reimagining Black Women, a critique of post-feminist and post-racial melodrama in culture and politics. Nicole, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, can you compare and contrast what you saw with police response on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol versus what you saw for Black Lives Matter protests over the course of last year?
Absolutely. And I think President-elect Biden really is spot on. What we see in the whole trajectory or arc of these protest events is completely different. We have police forces preparing before known protests to actually ramp up the police presence and actually have a more militarized kind of and very militant police presence there. We have hyper-surveillance and antagonism towards peaceful protesters who are thinking about social justice questions. And then as protests go along, we see people who at Black Lives Matter protests who are actually being mistreated, roughly handled, pushed to the ground, arrested. In contrast, what we see in terms of the Capitol on January 6th is totally different, right? We have beforehand other law enforcement organizations, New York and the FBI, contacting Capitol Police to tell them about pending problems in terms of violence. We see the day of Capitol Police really not only not doing the kind of typical things that police officers and peacekeepers are trained to do in terms of monitoring crowds, thinking about who's there, what's happening. We actually saw them coddling or interacting with some of the people there in a completely different way. And after, during and after the aftermath of it, we saw a very different kind of approach to handling. Really, you saw people being escorted away, right? And there was a kind of in a situation where force was something that was actually arguably warranted in some cases. We saw police really reticent to use that and to do the kinds of things that they're trained to do. So we saw a completely different approach, and it has everything to do on a basic level with how people oftentimes see protests about social justice issues and Black protesters in particular as a threat. Right, as abject figures, as inherently violent. And so it's astounding, really, that when the FBI is sending messages to the Capitol Police about possible violence, and this is a large protest that they knew was going to be happening, that actual objective information about violence was something that was looked over, whereas we know that the Capitol Police in many other instances will certainly ramp up security and have different types of means of doing so. So the contrast is stark. I also want to just point out too that this is not a difference just in degree, but in kind in terms of what people are dealing with. We have on the one hand, there's no kind of false equivalence that we can make. Black Lives Matter protesters were and are enacting their right to protest for social justice. What we saw on January 6th was a attempt to overthrow the U.S. government, a failed attempt to overthrow the U.S. government, but an attempt nonetheless. And so this is, we have a very different kind of situation that we're comparing, and we need to focus on that element too. Some Republicans have been bold enough to make comparisons in that way, and those are absolutely out of order.
I want to give a listen to a Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri talking during the voting that eventually ended up happening after the Capitol was cleared. He ultimately objected to a couple of the election results, talking here about the incident earlier that day. Here's a listen.
I just want to acknowledge that when it comes to violence, this has been a terrible year in America this last year. We've seen a lot of violence against law enforcement, and today we saw it here in the Capitol of the United States. And in this country, in the United States of America, we cannot say emphatically enough, violence is not how you achieve change.
Hawley there, condemning the violence in the Capitol that day, but it pointing back toward the last year, I think referring to some of the violence that happened after the peaceful protests for Black Lives Matter. You say you don't see the equivalence.
Not at all. And it's a perfect example, actually, of exactly what I was talking about. Right. So we have to, first of all, again, understand that there is a substantive difference in terms of what transpired. We know that what was happening on January 6th was the result of really, much and in this case, months, if not more, of incitement by something that we've really never seen. And this is interesting, too. Part of the function of these false equivalencies that this Republican congressman made is really to actually cover over their own complicity. We saw something in this election cycle that we have not seen in modern times, where we have a sitting president openly, blatantly, repeatedly stating that they will not honor election results that do not have them in a second term. President Trump didn't do this under a rock. He didn't hide it. He was consistent. And most importantly, he did it with the support and blessing of the Republican establishment, from the Secretary of State to the Attorney General Barr, who jumped ship, towards the end of the presidency. And also to the head of the U.S. Senate, Mitch McConnell, not actually affirming the election results, right? Leaving, not only leaving space, but saying things that actually affirmed what the president was doing in terms of undermining our faith in this democracy. We know that ideas about election fraud are just that. They're ideas, and they're dangerous ideas that are not based on facts. And so we have a context here that people like the Republican congressperson that you shared some comments from, that they are actually just willfully ignoring, because it has been a major context for understanding what happened on January 6th. It just didn't happen out of nowhere, right? This is something that has been really brewing for some time, actively pushed by this administration, undergirded by politicians who are more concerned about staying in office than in upholding the Constitution. And they have to bear some responsibility for what has happened and what is to come, because this, I believe, is just the beginning of what we will see in coming years in terms of violence directed, you know, at our government, and that will undermine our democracy. And so I can't underscore emphatically enough that we can't even compare the nature of what happened, the insurrection that happened, with what was happening, you know, in terms of Black Lives Matter. The violence that we saw most especially was a difference in police conduct. We saw police showing up, and even the government hiring paramilitary forces to be deployed to hotspots. He had his attorney general declare certain zones as special zones for possible conflict, really targeting places that were having Black Lives Matter protests, people who were fighting against injustice, who were having protests to highlight and underscore how Black lives are treated differently, are not recognized in the same way in terms of law enforcement. And we have to, I think, really aggressively resist the effort to flatten the terrain. Violence is not violence. We have to understand the context. We have to understand the facts. And we really need to deal with the fact that we have within our police apparatus a complicity that undergirds what's happening with nationalistic and even authoritarian forces in this country. So this is a huge wake-up call.
Talking to Nicole Alexander Floyd, Associate Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, looking at the police response to protests and the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, and how that compared to police presence at protests last summer, often led by Black Lives Matter organizers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the topic. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with political scientist Nicole Alexander Floyd from Rutgers, looking at how law enforcement responded to the Capitol insurrection, how it compares to Black Lives Matter protests and the police response there, and what it can all tell us about race and policing more broadly. You could join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mac is with us in Dubuque. Mac, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Mac?
Well, I think that we should realize as a country that we have had a problem with the white power movement and paramilitary operations in America since the beginning, like Bring the War Home by Kathleen Ballou. She describes in it about how since the 80s we've had white supremacists recruiting. And the problem with that is when they get into it, they learn about weapons and everything else. And then when you have to have a police response, that makes it even harder. Because they are trained. So in my perspective or thoughts, it would be better to have high visibility for police officers. It would be better to have horses like they do in Mardi Gras to kind of deter or detract from people gathering or grouping or clumping. And they really just have to learn to have high visibility. That was just my thought on it.
Mac, thanks a lot for the call. And that, Nicole, is, as you've mentioned, and many people pointed out, that's not what we saw on January 6th, that kind of high visibility reaction. And you talked some about this earlier, but why do you think we didn't see that?
Well, that is a million-dollar question. Why didn't we see that? Right? Because I totally disagree with the head of the Capitol Police who stepped down, who has repeatedly said that we were simply overwhelmed, that this was a tactical failure and we just have to review things. No, actually, this kind of thing was exactly what Capitol Police are trained and charged to do. We cannot discount, right, the fact that, again, the Capitol Police received direct intel from NYPD and the FBI. And at that point, the FBI had actually interviewed at least a dozen or so of these violent insurrectionists. And so that information was something that people had access to. So we do have to ask the question, given this information, why didn't we know? Even if you didn't have this kind of direct information, it was well known that this kind of protest was happening, that people were really wrongly assuming that this election was unfairly decided, that there was fraud in place, which we know is not the case. So people should have been on alert. The police should have been alert. We should have had greater visibility and a kind of presence there, and that did not happen. We have to really understand that some of the people within the U.S. Capitol Police Force are actually, I think, consistent in their belief system with those persons who were protesting. We need to understand why we had panic buttons that were not operating, how people actually got understanding of the layout of the U.S. Capitol in order to make particular types of maneuvers. So we at this point don't know the full scope of complicity of various actors, but there is no rational explanation for the U.S. Capitol Police and law enforcement for not having a better kind of security apparatus in position. And look, and this is tough stuff to really kind of let sink into your heart and mind, right? But we have to understand, the caller, Matt, pointed out that the white power movement has been developing for some time. There are several different threads of support for the Trump presidency. Right. Definitely. He has boldly said that he is a white nationalist. We saw early on in his presidency how he supported white supremacists in Virginia. And we know that there is a white Christian nationalism in the Republican Party that has undergirded this president as well. And those are difficult kinds of conversations to have. The missing piece, and political scientists like myself, Ron Walters, and others have pointed out that we also have not only had a kind of white power movement in a kind of general way, we've also had a white nationalism that we can see identified with the state, meaning we have had members of parties, particularly the Republican Party, specifically opposing affirmative action, opposing social welfare policy that could really benefit all of American people in America, but you're targeted in targeting people in terms of public policy, there'll be a black or brown face associated with it. Of course, family welfare policy is the thing that we can think of most especially. But we have all of these outgroups, right, that we create, whether it be immigrants, whether it be black women who are female-headed single parent. Heads of households, and we really generate this kind of nationalistic idea of who belongs and who doesn't belong. And so we see a very powerful and dangerous convergence, right, of different threads of political support that really help to explain this particular moment. And so when we ask the question, why didn't we see a different approach here, it is a really complex and bracing answer. It's because there are people in Congress and people within the Capitol Police who are actually in agreement politically with the ideologues who were the insurrectionists on that day. We will find out the extent to which and the breadth of the complicity. But that is something that we cannot deny. And it's really striking that the Republican congressperson, even after this attempted insurrection, goes on to still try to vote in objection to results for our electoral college that are be really beyond reproach in terms of their validity. And so, again, we have to hold people to account.
We just have a minute or two left, Nicole. What would you hope to see? I've seen some people critical of the police response in the Capitol saying, we're not saying, you know, we wanted them to shoot lots of people there. We didn't want the Capitol Police shooting people, but rather, I guess, a consistent response, regardless of who is doing the protesting. Briefly, how do we get from where we are today to there?
Right, exactly. A consistent response. And what needs to happen is that we need to root out the those forces within law enforcement that are supportive of insurrection, supportive of these white supremacist attitudes. And we also need to have some serious accountability in terms of how we got to this moment, right? In terms of the Republican establishment, we cannot get away from the fact that Trump is not the only one who is to blame here. And I'm really confident that General Honoré, who has been put in charge of really investigating this situation, is going to, I think the right person for this job. And I will say, in terms of the effort to defund the police in general, Black people are disproportionately attacked by police and are seen as a threat. It's also the case that many people have to deal with police surveillance. And because we have used our police forces to raise funds for our municipalities, we have put ourselves in a situation that actually heightens, right, the kind of biases that are in place, because we're trying to actually use them to raise resources for municipalities. And so we see people who are stepping up police enforcement because they want to raise money. That's also an issue that we have to deal with, and it's something that impacts us all. Hopefully, we will see very aggressive measures to transform in our society.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Nicole Alexander Floyd, Associate Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, looking at the police response to events at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th and how it compared to police presence at Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. New survey of UW-Madison students shed some light on their feelings about a variety of issues related to free speech. The survey, done by the university's Tommy Thompson Center on Leadership, asked 530 undergraduates to respond to a list of statements about how the government and public universities should handle different types of speech, including hateful remarks, biased media reports, climate change denial, and more. The center calls the results troubling and is recommending that the university do more to educate incoming students about the First Amendment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a current or recent college student, how do you feel about the free speech climate on your campus? Do you feel like some ideas aren't welcome, or does the balance feel okay? If you're an educator, have you noticed free speech issues coming up in your classroom? And how do you teach about free speech? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Ryan Owens is a professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership. Ryan, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, what were you looking to find out when you started this survey?
Well, you know, I think the more I have taught, the more I have heard students say things to me like, well, I hesitate to say this because, or, you know, maybe after class, they'll say something to me like, well, I really wanted to make this point, but I knew that my colleagues wouldn't approve of it, or maybe they didn't like it and I didn't want to offend anybody. And I've just been hearing more and more of this. So I wanted to reach out and see, you know, what the climate is like on campus. I mean, what do students think about their ability to say things? You know, what are they thinking about as they think about what kind of speech is protected and not protected? And more specifically, I'm just curious about their views on general free speech principles, their degree of tolerance for ideas that they may disagree with, and frankly, you know, with which, you know, we may all disagree with and find, you know, detestable and certainly contested. And, you know, as I say in the report, the results, I think, are troubling. We have Nearly 40% of students believe that the government should restrict the speech of climate change deniers. Over 50% of students believe that the government should restrict the speech of racially insensitive people. 63% believe the government should punish hate speech. Now, to be clear, some of these topics are a little bit broader and people could use their subjective judgment or what we meant by it. But in some respects, that's kind of the point as well. And I think taken together, these results are telling. They suggest that there is a degree of acceptance for restrictions on speech. And again, this may be speech that's detestable, but I think we've all for centuries now believed that, protecting speech in the long run is the thing that we want to do.
And one of your concerns is whether students understand First Amendment protections and whether a government not just should, but can restrict certain kinds of speech. What are your thoughts on what your students do, what the students, not just your students, what the students right. surveyed know and don't know?
Well, for my money, it's more important to think about, what they're thinking about these general principles, right? How acceptant are they of government telling them what to say and what not to say? And it seems like they're becoming more tolerant of that. So, I think it's a function of, we know that when students are sort of taught about First Amendment principles, about how the First Amendment has been interpreted in this country over time, they become a little bit more cognizant of the importance of free speech. They understand that, while they think they may have the right argument today, people, 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago also thought they had the right argument when they tried to quell the speech of others. And it gives them some perspective. If you think about this historically, over time, it has been the case that those with power have been the ones that want to silence those who are in the minority. You can see this across the board, but particularly here, you look at the abolitionist era, there were considerable attempts to silence abolitionists, and this is the kind of thing I think that we have to be cautious about, is to say, we've got to look at the long-term benefits of a free marketplace of ideas. We can fight like heck over the ideas that today we find reprehensible. And there are many, many ideas out there today that are reprehensible that we should object to. But that's a separate question about whether we want to give the keys to the vehicle, to the government, to tell us what to think and say.
Talking to Ryan Owens, professor of political science at UW-Madison, director of the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership, talking about a survey from the Center of UW-Madison undergraduates and issues of free speech or hate speech. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions, and your questions, 800-642-1234. I want to look at, I think this is the first question in the survey on hate speech. I'm going to quote it. Bear with me. Quoting, some people have argued that there is something called hate speech. They define it as abusive or threatening speech or writing that expresses prejudice against a particular group, especially on the basis of race, religion, or sexual orientation. End quote. Then you go on to ask about government being able to punish hate speech. Now, I don't want to get inside the head of the students here, but the word threatening is part of that. And there are points where threatening speech does cross the line into something the government might take action on. Do you think that there might be cues in here that make people think, no, I'm not worried about, speech about lowering the capital gains tax. I'm worried about hate speech that's threatening individuals or groups.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a legitimate point. But I guess a couple of things on that. The first is, I think when most students hear hate speech, they know what we're talking about here, right? And so I'm not particularly alarmed by that. If we give them a list of 5, 6, 7 things, and one of them is something that is protected, sure, that might explain some of their answers. But then when you go on to the next question and you ask them whether the government should be able to restrict the speech of racially insensitive people, that's about as clear as it gets. And there you've got over 50% of students believing that the government should do that. There's no wiggle room there, I think. Racially insensitive people, they ought not to be saying what they're saying, to be sure. There's no question about that. But I think, if there is any ambiguity in that first question, I think it's basically removed on the second question. And we get some results that are still a majority of students. So I think taken together, these results do suggest what we say they do.
Another issue you get into the survey has to do with speakers on campuses, whether they should be disinvited because their people worry their views will offend people. What kind of things did you find?
Well, there we found that there were, you know, approximately 35% or so students believe that public institutions should be able to revoke invitations to speakers who might offend someone with their speech. Now, you know, to be clear, the law on invitations and disinvitations at the university level it's not altogether a slam dunk on this. But again, the question is more or less about the general views of that. You know, do you think that you should, you know, revoke an invitation simply because someone might be offensive to another person? You know, and that, again, that suggests that a substantial minority of students are okay with, you know, yanking that platform for people under those conditions.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I was just thinking about, you know, this. I'm old enough to remember the Fairness Doctrine when that was required when people used the public airways. So I'm concerned, I guess, not so much just on campus, but in general, that opposing views can sometimes just be outright lies meant to incite violence or insurrection in the case of what just happened in our Capitol. And I listen to these stations once in a while just to get an alternative view, just to hear what they're saying. And what they're saying is they're sort of encouraging people to take on the government with all these lies about conspiracy theories and the government, you know, Joe Biden is going to raise your taxes, he's going to take your jobs, he's going to trash the environment. We're
Willem,
not going to be a great
I'll jump in. I think we get the gist. Ryan, Willem concerned if there are, say, in this case, media outlets fomenting violence, fomenting insurrection. Does that end up going, I guess, beyond the their First Amendment protections?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the court in First Amendment law is already pretty clear that incitement to violence is not protected speech. And that's certainly not anything that we're addressing in this matter at all. But, you know, I do think that Willem makes a good point. And it's something that I've been telling people over the last couple of weeks is that, look, there is an increasing amount of intolerance creeping into our culture, into our society, into our politics, just across the board. And it's not a good thing. And I think as we look across the spectrum, as we look out at politics today, the more we find that people are cabined off into their own informational silos. And sometimes it's that people are intolerant of others. Sometimes it's that they don't even know what other people are thinking and saying because they're not exposed to it. That's a real problem. And I do think that, you know, a good, solid understanding of the First Amendment, exposure to ideas with which you disagree, is healthy. It can help improve our politics to the degree that people can cross-pollinate with others. You know, it used to happen all the time in things like churches and trade groups and block parties. And the more siloed off we get, the less exposed we are to other people. And it becomes very, very easy to become intolerant of their views at that point.
Talking to Ryan Owens, professor of political science at UW-Madison, director of the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership there. He's talking with us about the center's new survey on how UW students feel about protecting or restricting different types of speech. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about a lack of tolerance on campuses, maybe here in Wisconsin, when it comes to different political points of view? Have you experienced this yourself, maybe as a student or faculty member? Do you have questions for our guest about his survey? And coming up, we'll get into some suggestions that he's looking for to change things and to promote free speech on campus. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Ryan Owens, political science professor and director of UW-Madison's Tommy Thompson Center on Leadership, looking at their new survey on free speech issues on the UW campus. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts and questions. Do you worry about political intolerance on college campuses, maybe elsewhere? Have you experienced it yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. one, two, three, four. Ryan, in your report going along with the survey, you have some thoughts on how UW-Madison and presumably other campuses could help promote free speech and respect for free speech. What kind of things would you look for?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you used the word help there, because that's the one thing that I really want to underscore with this. The purpose of this report really was to help help us figure out, is there a problem? And if so, what can we do about it? The whole motivation behind this was to be helpful and to see what we can do to help our democracy move forward and be better civilians to one another, better civic engagers, so to speak. So what we concluded with at the end was not some, you know, one or two absolutely necessary fixes that we think the university needs to make. Rather, we indicated there are a couple of things they might want to do. One possibility would be to require students to take a class on the First Amendment before they graduate. They do already require a number of courses to graduate, general education courses. This could be among those particular courses. Alternatively, we could see the university potentially offering more training to incoming students as their freshmen during their SOAR informational session. That could be something useful. And look, I mean, the university already does some of this. Students who are coming in are required to take a class on sexual harassment and assault, a class on alcohol use, drug abuse. They're required to take some training on diversity. It seems to me that this would be something that they could ramp up a little bit at that time, just to prepare them as they come into college to be good stewards, to be good citizens on campus, and you know, tolerate other views.
We heard from John from Lake Holly, who says free speech does mean you could say what you want, but it doesn't, John says, give you the right to a venue to speak at, like a college speaker, for example. And yeah, there's not an infinite number of speaker spaces, I guess, at a college campus. Ryan, so the idea of who gets a platform and who doesn't. How would you like to see a university or student groups make those decisions?
Well, that's a very good question. And look, I think there are numerous ways that this could be done. But the underlying point here is the question of the free speech principle itself. How tolerant are you? How open are you to discussing ideas with other people versus being eager to shut them down without having that that discussion? It's a difficult thing to do, to be sure. But I do think that if we're here trying to cultivate minds, to expose students to different points of views, to make them grow as citizens and as scholars and as future employees and employers, we want them to have inculcated, virtues in the civic arena that say, look, we can debate, we can discuss, and hopefully the best ideas will come forward. I think that's the general thing that we need to keep our eye on here.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. I, as an American, I look at this question of rights from a position of responsibility. So freedom of speech is guaranteed by our Constitution, but it matters when it occurs on private property or on public property. Now, what I mean by that, I can stand in the corner of Belknap and Tower in Superior and speak about any topic I want. It's public property. But if I'm on private property, I'm accountable to the person who owns the property. So there's an issue of authority that enters into the picture. But it all comes down to responsibility of the speaker. And I think that's where the real education needs to take place. Thank you.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Ryan, what do you think?
Well, I think there's a part of that is absolutely 100% correct. There are rights and responsibilities. For myself, I certainly don't like it when I see speakers come in and just be, crazy to be crazy, right? Aggressive in order to be aggressive. I don't think that moves the ball forward at all. I certainly don't enjoy seeing speakers come in and really do stupid things on campuses just to rile people up. I don't think that's a good use of the right. But I think what we have to ask ourselves here is, what kind of culture are we cultivating here when we have students who say, you know, they don't think it's appropriate for someone to engage in debate over climate change, right? That the government should be able to shut them down. Now, people can have different views on this, to be sure, but allowing the government to restrict that speech, and when you, I mean, think about that a little bit more, what does it mean to say that the government can restrict the speech of so-and-so? Does it mean that you have to pay a fine if you say something? Does it mean you have to go to jail for saying something like that? I think once we start digging down into this a little bit more, I think people then perhaps, maybe hopefully, will become more and more uncomfortable with some of those ideas. But again, it's about the long-term game here. It is about protecting us from government overreach, from government coming in, telling us what we can think, what we can do. Because again, we've known that throughout history, that is what people will do when they get in power. They will try to snuff out their opponents in whichever way they can. And so free speech is a protection for us. It is a way for us to be protected against people, factions, if you will, taking over the government and stifling our liberties. Sometimes it sucks, to be sure. I'll be the first one to admit it. But the end game is something that we've got to keep our eye on.
So if I could ask you just on a practical level in your own classrooms, how do you try to facilitate positive discussions where people feel comfortable expressing different points of view? It's, I mean, in any case, that can be a challenging thing to pull off.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, I think, you know, I try to be as open with my students as I can. I tell them, you know, as long as you are, you know, respectful to your colleagues, you're not name calling or things like that, you know, you say what's on your mind. You know, be collegial, be respectful. You're all adults, act like it. And look, I've been very pleased overall with the openness that I can find in my classroom. I do have students who say that they're uncomfortable saying things and they kind of self-silence as a consequence, but I tell them, don't do that. I mean, don't do that. Say your point. This is college. You're adults. You want to be treated like adults. That's great. I'm happy to do that with you. And then we can discuss it. And that I hope is sufficient to open up that discussion.
Do you, I know that, I think this is the first time you've done this particular survey, but just subjectively from where you're sitting, do you see a trend in a positive or negative direction over the years when it comes to speech on campus?
Well, I can't really speak to that in terms of my survey because this was only just a one-shot deal. There are numbers of other surveys where students have said essentially the same thing that they told me. I think Pew and Knight have done some surveys on this recently, and they have found similar results with a trend that's going, you know, opposite of the free speech principles. Again, that's not something that I found from my data because it was just a one shot survey.
Sure. And just our last minute, leave us with your thoughts for, I guess, campus administrators, what you're hoping they do with this survey.
Yeah, I guess I would like to see them take a look at this and investigate maybe a little bit further. Perhaps they can do another survey of their own. Perhaps they can work with us. We could work with them or some others to investigate this, to see what's going on, maybe system-wide, and really get our hands dirty in figuring out what is happening here. Because look, if we want to create an unfettered marketplace of ideas and a place for academic scholarship where ideas win the day, I think we've got to make that foundation strong there. So I'm hopeful that they will take a look at this and investigate it, take it seriously, perhaps change some of the structures that they have with their orientation to get students a little bit more familiar with First Amendment principles, and we can build from there. I'm hopeful, and we'll see what happens.
Ryan, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Ryan Owens is a professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership. He talked with us about the center's free speech survey of UW undergraduates and why he's recommending that the university require, among other things, more education for incoming students about the principles of the First Amendment. You can find a link to the survey at WPR.org/centraltime.